Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett, CorbettReport.com. Today is the 3rd of June, 2013, here in the land of the rising sun. It is still the 2nd of June, 2013, back in the United States, where I'm joined from the West Coast by Jan Ervin, who should probably need no introduction to most of my audience, being, of course, the host of GnosticMedia.com and a fellow member of the Tragedy and Hope community at TragedyandHope.com. Jan Ervin, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time today.
James, thanks for having me on. And first off, I want to give you a big congratulations for your new baby boy. And that's a huge thing, especially when baby boys seem to be not as many as they used to be.
I've noticed that myself. In fact, most of my friends here in Japan have had girls. And so I was relieved to see that there's another boy in the world. And it is interesting how that works, especially given some of the historical calls for eliminating males from the population. And lo and behold, that's exactly what's happening, and we found the endocrine disrupting chemicals in the water supply. But maybe that's a story for another day. For today, I would like to concentrate on a fascinating article that you published last month on GnosticMedia.com, Manufacturing the Deadhead, a Product of Social Engineering, which gets into a fascinating field of research tying in Gordon Wasson and the CIA and MK Ultra and the creation of the 60s drug counterculture into a fascinating thesis. And it's difficult to summarize this, but one sentence that is particularly intriguing is that it says here, for example, the counterculture had been developed by elements within the U.S. government and banking establishment as part of a larger plan to bring about a new dark age, or as it was marketed to potential victims, an archaic revival. And this gets into all sorts of fascinating fields of nooks and crannies of research. And you begin the article by talking about your research from last year showing that Gordon Wasson had been linked even in primary documents with the CIA. But I'm not sure if you want to start there, or perhaps we could start even further back talking about the actual origin of LSD, which is not what most people think it is in the popular imagination. But again, where would you like to start this conversation?
Sure. Well, you know, why don't we start off or give people a little bit of background on how I got into this area of research, and then from there we'll take it back to ancient Greece and then come forward. So back in originally in 2005, I published a book called Astrotheology and Shamanism, where we were looking at the history of drugs and astrotheology as a basis of Judeo-Christianity. In there, we published some primary ancient Christian documents from the 4th century church father Epiphanius, talking about how the birth of Jesus was based on the solar calculations around the Christmas celebrations. And so this was a primary document that essentially proved that. But while researching that, we came across a lot of the attacks that have been published out there for many years against the Dead Sea Scrolls scholar and famous or infamous author of the Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And the reason why, since 2009, I've been into his work is because with his daughter in 2009, we republished his book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. But in from 2006 until 2008, I was investigating his background and all of these attacks that were published everywhere against him in the media by Gordon Wasson and the psychedelic community, in the academic community. And we were going through essentially myself and Allegra's daughter and looking up each of the attacks and pulling up the original citations, seeing what he wrote and what the claims were against him. And what we found out writing that book was that a man named R. Gordon Wasson, who is the so-called discoverer of magic mushrooms, he launched all of the attacks against Allegro. So on doing more research on his background, I later discover that he's the vice president of propaganda for J.P. Morgan Bank, etc. But anyway, in writing my book, The Holy Mushroom, that really, you know, what we did was not only did we publish the first primary medieval Christian text specifically discussing the use of the holy mushroom in the Greek Orthodox Church, but we also published 41, there's in the color edition, I published 41 color iconographic images showing the mushrooms, and we did a line by line showing Allegro's claims, the attacks against him, and then debunking it. And we literally refuted every single attack against this area of his research regarding the sacred mushroom and the cross and any associations of mushrooms being used in Judeo-Christianity. Now, you know, a lot of people will say, well, I've taken mushrooms. They're a spiritual thing, and there's no way that anybody could be using these for a negative thing. Well, you know, when we begin to think of the Jewish and Christian churches being patriarchal churches, and then we begin to think of how now we have evidence that they were in fact using these things. In the Book of Zohar, there's a reference to the red mushroom or red fungus being used there. And so we have references to these things. Now, these are patriarchal religions. So this should give us pause, which is what happened to me when I was writing these books, is going, now, wait a second. Are they for spiritual, or is there something else going on? So I want to make clear to the listeners, because I get a lot of attacks for this, and a lot of people will say, no, it was all blowback. All the CIA agents, they're just dumb dupes. They couldn't have done this stuff. And so, you know, when we step back and we look at this other side of these things, that maybe they weren't just dupes and maybe this was intentional, then it shows us that the church used them for control. And going all the way back to bring up a point that you brought up at the beginning, we look at the Eleusinian mysteries. Now, interestingly, the word mystery means to mystify, to stupefy, to dumb down or control, essentially. So in the word, or in the name Eleusinian mysteries, they're telling us what it is. And so I began looking at this, and back in 1976, Gordon Wasson, Carl A.P. Ruck of Boston University, and Albert Hofmann, who supposedly invented LSD, wrote this book, The Road to Ulysses, stating that, you know, this was a society, an example of a society that was all based on psychedelic spirituality. Well, I begin to look at it, and it turns out that there's two families that control the entire celebration at Ulysses. I forget their names in ancient Greek. And they basically kept control, and the government had control of this drug initiation for 2,000 years. And so, you know, they'll claim that, you know, it was a spontaneous thing that it managed to be kept secret throughout all of this time. Meanwhile, saying that guys like Socrates were killed for exposing it.
Well, that's a fascinating bit of the puzzle there. But let's bring this back to the present times. And what you're talking about is this idea of archaic revival that was floated by people like Terence McKenna and others. But what you draw out in the article is how this is very much a self-conscious attempt to debase the culture and to degrade people's ability to actually rationally function. Let's talk about that in some more detail and some of the connections between, for example, people like Terence McKenna and Timothy Leary and even Marshall McLuhan.
Well, you know, and that's just right. In fact, Marshall McLuhan, speaking of him, he is the one who developed the term tune in, turn on, drop out that was later reiterated by Timothy Leary. Now, both Timothy Leary and Terence McKenna cite Marshall McLuhan as one of their largest influences. Marshall McLuhan also was influenced by I.A. Richards, who is the one who came up with the 850-word international English language, which is a dumbed-down version of the language, right? Marshall McLuhan was also influenced by a guy who was a Jesuit priest by the name of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who is often cited by guys like Edmund Rothschild in the UNCED or UNCED conferences that were researched by George Hunt. And Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, he's also the guy who came up with the Omega Point theory that later became morphed into Terence McKenna's Time Wave Zero and the 2012 theory. Now, part of the 2012 theory also came from CIA agent Michael Coe, who was a professor at Yale. He was CIA for Japanese intelligence, interestingly. And, you know, so getting into Terence McKenna, but, you know, aside from these, he's also influenced by transhumanism. Now, Sir Julian Huxley, the infamous eugenicist who is brother to Aldous Huxley, who helped found the Esalen Institute, he created transhumanism. And so we have Terence McKenna being influenced by these very things. Terence McKenna also went to this interesting place at when he was up at Berkeley called the Tusman Experimental College. Now, interestingly, in Terence's books, he talks about now I'm forgetting the name of the book. It's his like third or fourth book, though, the one where he's telling the story of his time down in South America. But in this book, he talks of being wanted by Interpol and the FBI, and then no conclusion of this is ever mentioned. And then suddenly he's back in Berkeley, and then he runs again back down to the Amazon because he hears that the FBI is after him. And both times that the FBI and Interpol are after him, no conclusion of this is ever brought up. Now, I have filed FOIA requests with the CIA, and I have appealed these FOIA requests all the way up, and the CIA is going to force me to do a jury trial to try and get Terence McKenna's documents out of them. But Terence McKenna goes on, you know, he cites this idea of the overmind and the oversoul that was created by Jung. And again, he created this habit and novelty theory that was influenced by the Jesuit priest. He also created the stoned ape theory, which was proved false by Dr. Brian Akers, where he provably falsified many of his citations, like to professors such as Roland A. Fisher. And so, you know, that sort of just kind of snowballs from there. But one of Terence's largest influences, as he admits in his own work, and he gets heavily into, I should say, cybernetics, is a big influence of his is Alfred North Whitehead and John B.S. Haldane, who is a eugenicist. But one of his largest admitted influences is Aldous Huxley. And as far as I can tell from researching all of this stuff over the last, I started this particular line of research in about 2006. And as far as I can tell, Aldous Huxley is the key guy behind MKUltra. And for instance, in his book Moksha on page 56, right there, he's talking about this doctor from Egypt that he worked with. And where he basically pretended that, you know, and it's explained in another story elsewhere that he pretended to be a doctor and went around with this Dr. Gödel in Egypt who had dosed his patients. But also on page 56, and it's like October 25, 1954, we see Aldous Huxley talking about Andrea Puhrich's LSD experiments. Now, Andrea Puhrich was at Edgewood, Maryland. He's one of the key guys behind MKUltra. Andrea Puhrich also ran the Council of Nine out of the Esalen Institute, which has ties into the Kennedy assassination and all of this stuff. So here's Aldous Huxley talking about the latest research before anybody else has any idea of what's going on. But in this book and throughout the book, we see him going to universities and going to the labs and, you know, and talking about the latest research all the while. He's giving us a warning. Ooh, you know, we've got to look out. Look what they're doing over there. Oh, but let me just go in and stay. Oh, and by the way, here's some ideas for your study. And so he's actually directing the studies. And then when we look into Aldous's background, we discover that he's a Fabian socialist, which is a wolf in sheep's clothing. So it's constantly, you know, as a good Fabian, look over here, folks. Don't look at me and my brother and my family and Esalen and all the things we're doing, you know, and Eisenhower did the same thing. You know, Eisenhower and Huxley and Gordon Wasson, they're all at the Century Club together, and Eisenhower's on TV saying, look out for the military-industrial complex. So this is their trick. It's, you know, look over here, look out for these guys. Meanwhile, they're actually the ones doing it.
That's such an important point, and one that I really want listeners to think about, because I've gotten a lot of feedback over the years that from what I've done on Aldous Huxley, trying to point out his eugenicist connections and the fact that he was lamenting this in his final
Revolution talk. Oh, sure. Always. Always.
Absolutely. Wolf in sheep's clothing. Well, extremely important connections. Let's talk some more about how the media campaign to promote this culture worked, because the ties and linkages there between, for example, Time Life and J.P. Morgan and Timothy Leary and all of this is really fascinating. Let's talk about some of those connections.
Oh, well, when we get into the history of Time Life, well, first we have to go all the way back to my first article, which I released on May 13, 2012, regarding Gordon Wasson. It was called Gordon Wasson, The Man, The Legend, The Myth. And in there, I did a background on Wasson and his bosses and all of this good stuff. But it turns out that Gordon Wasson, one of his bosses at J.P. Morgan, or one of the head guys that he worked with, was Henry P. Davison. Henry P. Davison graduated Skull and Bones in 1920 with Henry Luce, who founded Time Life magazines. So Henry P. Davison was actually on the board of directors of Time Life magazines, and he was one of the original funders to help get the organization started. Now, there was another a couple of other guys that were there on the – let me just see if I can find some of my connections here. And I'm just looking in the brain database here, just pulling them up here. So aside from Henry Luce being there, we also have C.D. Jackson, who is the head of U.S. Psychological Warfare. He's one of the guys that also shows up at the infamous Buchenwald video holding up the pelvis and this sort of stuff, right? And then we have Dwight Morrow there. And I think he might have been another Skull and Bones. And then there's Britton Hayden there, who is also Skull and Bones. So we have all of these Skull and Bones guys directly behind the creation of Time Life. And then we have Abby Hoffman and these people, or Abby Hoffman is having a conversation with Luce's own wife, Claire Booth Luce, about how she thinks that Luce did more to popularize LSD than Timothy Leary did. And of course, Timothy Leary learned about magic mushrooms from, Time Life magazine. And interestingly, about 10 feet from me, which I put them just out of reach by mistake, I have some 1960s copies of Life magazine where on the cover it's like the new dangers of this drug, you know, and then it's all about all of these experiments and all, you know, what you could expect by taking it. It's like this big promotion of it, right? So it's all this tongue in cheek. Be afraid. Here's a commercial for it. You know, it's like the American drug war, you know, it's like, they show you a commercial on television about not doing drugs, and all you can think about is, man, you know, does anybody have a joint? So, you know, it's this sort of tongue in cheek constantly going on with their work, where they're promoting it and warning people about it and this sort of thing. And so they're all tied in with the Fabians and whatnot. I'm not sure if Luce was a Fabian too. That would be interesting to find out. But let me see here. We do have George Orwell, who was Aldous Huxley's student. He's there. Bertrand Russell was there. Annie Besant is another one who turns up there. H.G. Wells, and he constantly turns up in these studies. And, Theosophy and all of that good stuff turns up. Polly Toynbee, Sir Keith Murdoch is Sir John Maynard Keynes was another Fabian socialist, and he also worked with Aldous Huxley and met with Aldous and Wasson and Alan Dulles at the Century Club.
This is a who's who of early 20th century eugenicists. I mean, this is right. Absolutely everyone who's is important in that and surprisingly connected to this.
Let me just interject there. Hold that thought. Don't forget it, because, you know, we should really point out that Aldous and Julian Huxley, their grandfather was Sir Thomas Henry Huxley. Sir Thomas Henry Huxley was the PR manager for Darwin. He was called Darwin's bulldog. So essentially what you have is Julian picking up the academic portions. And in fact, even in Pierre Teilhard de Chardin's book is Julian Huxley's introduction. We have the 50th anniversary or 70th anniversary of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species with an introduction by Sir Julian Huxley, right? And then we have all of the novels by Aldous that promote the storyline into the general public. And they're also using, the Esalen Institute up in Northern California. And as far as I can tell, it's probably Michael Murphy up at the Esalen Institute up in Big Sur, Northern California, that's running most of the MKUltra type operations today, which would also include the Fourth World Wilderness Agenda and Agenda 21.
Well, that's exactly where I wanted to go with this, because of course MKUltra is an important piece of this puzzle, and I think most people have at least some understanding of MKUltra now as the mind control experiments of the CIA that most people believe was pretty much confined to the 1950s and experiments like that of Dr. Ewan Cameron. But of course, it was much bigger in scope, and it involved such things as, of course, the promotion of the drug culture. Let's talk about MKUltra, what it really stemmed from, where it's really going, and how it continues to this day.
Well, MKUltra appears to have stemmed out of the Macy conferences that were put on by Josiah Macy. And interestingly, the Josiah Macy Institute is still around today. But the Macy conferences... The people who were there were like Arturo Rosenbluth and John von Neumann. I already mentioned Josiah Macy. We have Kurt Lewin showing up there, who is another famous eugenicist. And Norbert Wiener, of course. And then the Tavistock Institute, they're constantly showing up when I do a background on a lot of this stuff. And I know you've talked about some of the Tavistock Institute material, but I think the issue with them is that they're a front organization that is used to do this research behind and where they direct money from. I think somebody showed a video once of this tiny little office building trying to, you know, refute the whole idea of the Tavistock Institute, but you don't need a large office. You know, these funds that Gordon Wasson and these people also ran, and the Gestichter Fund is another one that Wasson got money from for this mushroom research. You know, they don't need large offices. They just put a little address somewhere and they, you know, they do all of these types of things. But so out of the Macy conferences is essentially the key organization where the MKUltra project gets head. And we have guys like Gregory Bateson in there. Gregory Bateson was the husband of, if I can remember her name, Margaret Mead. And so, you know, he was there. I already mentioned Andrea Puhrich. He was in there. You mentioned Osmond. We have, Harold Abramson, Henry A. Murray. We've got Humphrey Osmond. Pierre Lafitte was the assassin of, Olson, Frank Olson, the Frank Olson murder. Of course, Sidney Gottlieb, who ordered the murder, and George Hunter White, Ewan Cameron, all of these guys, they're all in there. But it stems out of these Macy conferences along with, if we follow Gregory Bateson's background, of course, his largest influence is Aldous Huxley. He was dosed by Harold Abramson, works at the Macy conferences. He's also at the Lindisfarne Association, which is the same group that developed the Gaia hypothesis, interestingly. And they're all selling this whole fourth world wilderness agenda there. And so... The Lindisfarne Association is another really good one. Michael Murphy of the Esalen Institute, one of the original founders with Aldous Huxley, is right there at the Lindisfarne, along with Ralph Abraham and Gary Schneider, who's still a professor up at UC Davis, I believe, of English. And he is one of the guys there at the yacht with Timothy Leary and Alan Watts and these guys who helped decide what they were going to do with the Tune On meme. So in the article, we listed an audio there to Alan Watts' boat party. And here's, you know, Gary Schneider, the last living guy who is culpable in all of this, who is still a professor up at Davis. He was there a part of it. So, Elaine Pagels is also there at the Lindisfarne and all of this stuff. But you know, the Esalen Institute is really just a who's who of mind control and MKUltra. I mean, you know, on the Esalen Institute website, in their newsletters, they actually brag of B.F. Skinner, the creator of operant conditioning and the Skinner box. They brag about his tenure there.
Yay. Yes, absolutely. B.F. Skinner, what a wonderful character to be associated with that. Well, then specifically, how does MKUltra play into the creation and the propagation of the drug culture?
Well, apparently what they were trying to do is, you know, they figured that they would just use a multi-pronged attack Essentially, what they call this is the fourth world, or the battle for the mind. You have the first world, which is like the U.S. and Europe. The second world, which is Russia and Asia. Third world, which is Africa and South America. And then the fourth world, which is the mind. And so this guy, William Sargent, wrote this book, The Battle for the Mind, that goes into this whole idea. But at George Hunt was at this UNCED conference with Edmund Rothschild and these guys, they laid out what is the Fourth World Agenda in their own words right at this talk. So essentially, the psychedelic aspect is just one of these prongs that they use, and they'll sort of piggyback along with the psychedelics, things like the Gaia hypothesis and quantum physics and this sort of thing. A number of times, Rich has had on his show he's played the lecture from David Harriman, and I've interviewed David Harriman twice on my show, the author of Logical Leap, and he's got an excellent 6-hour lecture series called The Philosophic Corruption of Physics that shows how quantum physics was entirely, essentially created, and it basically fools us not to trust our own five senses and just look up citations to see what's there. It's a lot to go into here, and I know people get upset. Just, go to my website and study the interviews, and go to Richard Grove's Peace Revolution podcast, episode 62, and listen to all of that, and then decide for yourself what's really going on there. But when you put all of these things together, it's all about selling the idea that there is no truth, that we should just be positive and pillow sit. And the psychedelic movement is very much the New Age movement, and I know a lot of people would get very upset at that comment, but even Terence McKenna in Archaic Revival admits that his renaming, that he took the word New Age and renamed it Archaic Revival because it better described what it was about, which was the New Dark Age. And so, they're just using all of these things, piggybacking the CO2 so-called, environmental movement and the CO2 credit, carbon credit nonsense and all of this Agenda 21 stuff. But the idea is to get people essentially to not fact check, to not ask who, what, where, when, or why. Before they try and explain how to others on the way something is, they just don't gather any information at all.
Well, speaking of gathering information, it's important for the listeners to understand that we're talking about primary source documents here and things that you've uncovered, right, to specifically to do with MKUltra Subproject 58 and letters between Gordon Wasson and various CIA people.
Sure.
Tell us about those letters that you published.
Well, let's see. And in fact, I should probably go get the big box of documents. But I, since 2011 or 2010, I was basically trying to reverse engineer what was held at Harvard University at the Gordon Wasson archives there, because I knew that they were not going to let me in, just as they had been blocking many other researchers. And in fact, since Andy Letcher had published his book Shroom, pretty much all other researchers had been blocked. And so I knew that, I was just about beyond any doubt that they were going to block me. So I wanted to try and gather as much research as I could before I even tried to approach them. And how would I do that? Well, on the Harvard website for the herbaria for Gordon Wasson's archives there, they have a list of who is in the letters there, and you can use these and you can use other sources. And basically, there's two sides to every conversation. And of course, the archives at Harvard are only going to store one side of that conversation. So there's a lot of other universities out there with a lot of other people's works. And Wasson worked with many various levels of the intelligence community, et cetera. So first we went through getting documents from Princeton's Mudd Library, Yale, Columbia, Duke University, Dartmouth, Stanford, the Hoover Institute, UC Santa Barbara, etc. And we just basically went out there and gathered up what was about 1,000 pages of material that was unreferenced anywhere in the other archives or other materials, period, that anybody has written about on Wasson in the last 55, 60 years. And so then we had 1,000 pages of new documents to work with. And then on top of that, I had filed a FOIA request with the CIA on Gordon Wasson. And in fact, originally a so-called MKUltra researcher had offered to help me, but he delayed my research on all of that. And people can find out more on that in the article. But so we get these documents from the CIA and they send me about six pages. And three of them are personal correspondence between Wasson and Alan Dulles. And they are in the six to five weeks period following up just before the May 13, 1957 publication of Wasson's Life magazine article, where they launched the entire magic mushroom movement in Life magazine, popularizing the whole thing, which is where Timothy Leary learned of the whole thing from, supposedly.
Exactly right. So again, we have all of these connections back to Time Life as being one of these central hubs, which itself was funded and infested and created by Skull and Bones members, who themselves were the
and J.P. CIA. Morgan.
So I mean, right. it ties perfectly into this neat little bow, and specifically again back to this MKUltra Subproject 58. Tell us specifically about Subproject 58. What does this indicate? What does this mean? And how is this related to Wasson?
Well, the document showing what the CIA did was they did. I want to put up front, and we do address it in a lot of other work that we're covering. And when you look at the whole picture, it's just impossible. But what the CIA did was, in one line of all of the documents on Subproject 58, they put in the word "unwitting" in there regarding Gordon Wasson. But we have Wasson doing and promoting all of this stuff everywhere, and there's just too many things that he knows, like his attempt to recruit George Kennan to the CIA in 1956, etc. You know, these are just things that he can't be attempting to recruit the ambassador, the former ambassador to the Soviet Union, to the CIA if he's just an ignorant banker. And I've actually had, you know, there were attacks published on Reality Sandwich where people actually made up a whole different story about the letter and everything, a whole red herring or straw man trying to debunk me and that letter. But so this letter shows Wasson trying to recruit Kennan to the CIA. So we know that he's in there. He's at the CIA working with all of these guys. We have primary documents showing that he's working with Alan Dulles at the Council on Foreign Relations. We have primary documents that show that Wasson is working with Alan Dulles, President Dwight Eisenhower, and all of these other guys, including Aldous Huxley, at the Century Club. So we have this major tie-in with all of these primary documents that reveal this whole sort of layer, you know, of intelligence, you know, and how they were running this operation that they don't really want out to the public. I forgot your question, though.
So do I. Oh, yeah, I was asking about MKUltra Subproject 58, what it is.
Okay, so, yeah. So now Subproject 58, you know, this is what they're doing here is essentially we have Aldous Huxley in his book, Opening the Doors the Doors of Perception, where he starts to promote psychedelics out into the public. And then Wasson comes along and it's basically a big launch pad to launch the entire psychedelic movement from. So Wasson hits Life magazine and that goes out to however many millions and is on the front, you know, right in the newsstand of every grocery store, et cetera, in America. And then his wife, Valentina, that same week in one of Wasson's partners at J.P. Morgan, who owns another magazine, This Week magazine, it's like a parade magazine for those in the U.S. who would know about the little magazine that would go in, say, the Sunday newspaper. And so this magazine, this Week magazine, went out to an additional 12 million newspaper subscribers that same week. And so basically, or that same week, there was, you know, there were 5 days apart or 6 days on the 13th and the 19th. So basically what they did is they just blitzed the entire population with this whole thing. And then what they want people to believe is that it was all blowback. It was, you know, they were willful idiots. We even have, you know, comments of Wasson commenting to Bertram Wolf, how, do you remember where Tolstoy said the printing press was a mighty engine for disseminating ignorance? This Mazatec affair, meaning where he found the mushrooms in Oaxaca, Mexico, this Mazatec affair is a quote-unquote case in point. And so, you know, here he is, you know, giving this sob story about, you know, the damage that he did to Huautla de Jimenez down in Mexico, this Indian village. and then essentially bragging about it and doing more of the Fabian socialist sort of advertising it while you're crying, right? It's all tongue in cheek. You know, let's make sure that we're constantly promoting it in the newspapers because, you know, of course, Wasa needs to publish something in the newspaper, in the New York Times, to apologize for his actions. You know, so there's all of this sort of silly thing where they're doing one thing but saying another, and it's constantly like this throughout. So anyway, the whole thing, just to round off that point, the whole thing is really, I think, and people will attack me, and I have done entheogens many times, folks, and my co-author and I, Joe Atwill, and I were at difference on this because I think that the entheogens can be used if you do something, if you study something like the trivium for at least 2 or 3 years before you attempt it, whereas he's completely against it. There is a lot of potential for mind control there, and just because you believe they are spiritual tools doesn't mean the predator in the next neighborhood thinks that they're spiritual tools. And, you know, so we have to think that just because we see them one way doesn't mean the next guy does. And one of the CIA's own MKUltra researchers, Dr. Louis Jolyon West, talks about using drugs to target and control certain segments of the population. And so if you can get a bunch of people to think that this experience is spiritual, whether or not it is irrelevant. But while they're in that state, if they're not fact-checking things and they want to be positive and sit in, you know, and pillow sit and do all of this stuff anytime any negative information comes up. And I can't think how many times I've talked to so-called hippies and, you know, enlightened people that have tried psychedelics, and you try and discuss facts and they say, oh, well, you're being negative. I don't want to hear about that. You know, and it's just, you know, ignorance is bliss. I don't want to know anything. But I'm sorry, folks, if you're not aware of how you're being controlled, then you're being controlled and you're being ignorant about it, and it doesn't help your situation any. And so this is all, you know, key to bring it full circle and understanding, you know, how they promote these things. And just because what you think doesn't mean how the bad guy thinks that they're used.
Well, let's explore that controversy a little, because certainly in the popular understanding, the 60s drug culture and that subculture was all about rebellion. It was about going against the system. It liberated a generation, all of that kind of narrative that we have in the popular understanding. Sure. How then can you say that this was a mind control type of
development? Well, see, and it's how they use it. When you get in and study how they use the Kabbalah and things like that, you can see that the goal is to keep the person off balance. Now, in my own experience, in my early 20s, I did a massive, massive dose of mushrooms, and I'll admit that I had, you know, it was upwards of 15, 16 grams in silent darkness, and I'll admit that I had a very enlightening experience. But for years after that, because I lacked the critical thinking skills to remove the fallacies from my own mind, I couldn't see that all the things that I was getting into, trying to figure out what happened in that one experience, I couldn't see that how they were, you know, how they were all misleading me. And so, you know, like, you know, and, you know, there's like the positive thinking movement and all of these different movements. But just because you take a drug and become politically active doesn't mean you're being effective. Okay, so let's take, for instance, I've had on my show about 7 or 8 times Clint Richardson, who's exposed all of the CAFR research. And, you know, we've talked about this a number of times on my show, where here we have all of these Wall Street protesters over here focusing on this. Meanwhile, City Hall and your local county and state governments are the ones actually running all of that. So if they're over here, are they being effective when the target is over here? Or is it controlled opposition to get people to go chase after wild goose chases? Because if you don't know how to go back and check the primary citations and look up, you know, who, what, where, and when before you determine why or explain how, then it's very easy for you to get confused and get lost into your own thing. And not only that, but what they've done is they've created this entire new age secondary catch web that they use to get everybody caught into it if they break free of the major dogmatic religions. So you fall out of one and you might have a moment of, yeah, wow, I really get it. But if you don't have a systematic method for verifying reality, you're going to think, you know, whatever that you're told. And not only that, when you come down from that experience, they're going to tell you that there is no truth, that truth is arbitrary. And so therefore, you may as well not even look.
Exactly right. And I think, I mean, that's what we find from McLuhan's little phrase, tune in, turn on, drop out, which everyone thinks comes from Leary. But in fact, McLuhan gave it to him. And you have an interesting little story about where that comes from, and McLuhan singing some kind of Pepsi commercial catchphrase for the psychedelic movement to Timothy Leary, and he picks up on that and uses it as a method for basically extolling this to the masses. So it's
sure. And you, let me just interject there really quick that it's also very important to note that Marshall McLuhan wrote his PhD thesis on the classical trivium, not the trivium method, but on the classical trivium. And the classical trivium is a system of encircling or encapsulating the mind, or essentially mind control, which is what the trivium method actually reveals. So all of these guys, their influence goes right to this one guy. When if you understand that mind control and the classical trivium are the same thing, then you see why they're going all going up to Marshall McLuhan.
Well, I think we should take a moment to address that, because for people out there who have heard of trivium but associate that with the trivium method, perhaps you should explain what the classical trivium is.
Sure. Well, recently, Richard Grove and Kevin Cole on his show did a full expose, and Kevin Cole had been researching the background of the trivium, and you know, the ancient history of it all. And so I had been waiting to essentially do a show with him for more than a year, and so we finally just did a video with Rich, and we put it out on my show as well. But he had gone in and looking at to look at all of the origins of this stuff, just like, you know, we talked about I.A. Richards and these guys earlier and how they manipulate things. Another one was Adler, who was out of the University of Chicago, and he helped work on the great books of the Western world. So we started looking at some of these guys and how they were packaging the trivium and how they were telling people to study the great books of the Western world and things like this, which was essentially trying to guide people into a certain way of thinking without really grasping what it is. So, you know, the classical trivium will give you the seven liberal arts, for instance. They'll tell you, yeah, you know, it's the trivium and quadrivium, but they might say it's logic, grammar, rhetoric, music, geometry, arithmetic, astronomy. And when it's really, and they're always built on and based on each other, because one reveals the other, and one is, it's always a systematic method. So it's actually grammar, logic, rhetoric, who, what, where, when, why, and how. And then the quadrivium is arithmetic, music, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Arithmetic is number in itself. Geometry is number in space. Music is number in time. And astronomy is number in space and time. So when you get them in a systematic whole, it brings about a whole nother level of understanding and removing the fallacies or lies from our own thoughts and being able to get down and look for the primary documents before we decide what anything really is. And so this is always, you know, really key. Whereas otherwise, you know, if we're tricked to put logic before grammar, for instance, or why before who, what, where, and when, you know, it's like Richard Grove came up with, it's basically grammar or who, what, where, and when is input. Why or logic is processing, and rhetoric or how is output. So if you put why before input or you know, processing before input, what could you possibly be processing? And so, you know, going back to your question earlier, you know, how are they tricking everybody with the compulsory education system, with quantum physics, with all of these things that fall under the Fourth World Wilderness agenda? You know, it's just this multi-pronged attack on the mind, on critical thinking, and that's why it's called the battle for the mind.
And one of the interesting characters that I'm sure my listeners will be familiar with who finds his way into your article is Edward Bernays, who is, of course, the nephew of Sigmund Freud. Talk a little bit about him and his efforts at creation of counterculture.
Oh, well, let's see. Edward Bernays was actually, you know, once I figured out that Wasson was vice president of public relations or PR for J.P. Morgan Bank, then things started clicking. And I just had a hunch, you know, if Edward Bernays created propaganda and Wasson is vice president of J.P. Morgan Bank back in the 1920s and 1930s, And there's only like maybe 5 or 8 years separation between the publication of Bernays's book and Wasson getting hired at J.P. Morgan. What are the chances that there is some sort of relation there between the two? And, you know, so it turns out, you know, you go to the Century Club documents, and then Walter Lippmann, who is another father of propaganda, is working with Wasson also at the Century Club. But it's so it turns out I do a search, and at the U.S. Library of Congress, I found a letter written by Edward Bernays where he's talking about his 10-year friendship with Wasson. And so, you know, Edward Bernays, of course, popularized cigarettes. He promoted fluoride in the water. Fluoride is one of these chemicals that's used in Prozac to dumb the masses down, which again is this whole attack on the mind. But essentially, Bernays, he put together this multi-prong approach that we point out. You know, we point out six key factors: the music idols and music, the psychedelics, feminism. You know, for those who are unfamiliar with how feminism is mind control, I highly recommend studying this Canadian podcaster, Karen, who calls her YouTube channel is Girl Writes What. And I recommend everyone out in the audience watch and listen to everything she's ever put out because it's phenomenal research. And she completely exposes how feminism was essentially attack on the family. You know, see, if you understand that if you break apart the family is the core of the structure. If the society falls apart, everybody just goes back to their family units and doesn't give a crap about the rest of it. But if you can destroy the family unit and get a bunch of single moms who rely on the government, then we have a totally different story. And so they can protect themselves from ever, you know, collapsing that. So it's, you know, one of these things to, again, do constantly attack the family, the middle class, the family unit, and just break it down.
Well, let me echo that recommendation. I've only recently encountered Girl Writes What, but absolutely, if really interesting research going on there. Again, there's so many different threads to this that it might be confusing for people who haven't read the article. So, of course, I'm going to put the link into the show notes.
Sure.
I really do recommend that people go and read through the article and go into your previous research as well, including your research last year on Wasson. But why don't we go back to a point that I brought up at the very beginning of the conversation, and I don't want to let it go before we go. Talking about the creation of LSD and the popular narrative of how that went versus indications that that might not be the real story.
Sure. Well, you know, next month, in fact, a friend of mine out of England, Alan Piper, is going to be publishing a new paper in the journal Time and Mind that actually reveals that in 1933, a Jewish novelist by the name of Leo Perutz published a novel called St. Peter's Snow, where in this book, they are working with ergot derivatives of wheat to create a new, never-before-discovered psychedelic. And actually, they do talk about how they go back through and they're studying the ancient mysteries and things and trying to figure out what it is. And then they say, well, we think it's wheat and this rye. But in the story, they're very clear that it's not a chemical that's found naturally in nature, such as LSA, which is found in morning glories, and ergot naturally can produce LSA, which is maybe 100 times less psychoactive as LSD. And so, you know, there's only two or three. There's hydroxy LSA, LSA, and LSD. Those are the only possibilities for a hallucinogenic substance for this book to be talking about. So, you know, by process of logical deduction, none that are found in nature, we automatically remove LSA and hydroxy LSA, and we're left with LSD. So in this book, they're using LSD 10 years before Hoffman supposedly invents it to create a new religion to bring about, and this is a Jewish author writing about trying to bring about a Roman emperor to his throne. So, of course, more tongue and cheek stuff here. And then we have the storyline finishing with the chemist who actually invents the drug starting a communist revolution instead. And so, I mean, and when you see all of the tie-ins between you know, communism and how they've twisted the psychedelic revolution without critical thinking, it all makes a really tidy package. And here this guy, he's either, you know, magic and predicting the future, or he's a scion or something like that, and he's got an in, and he knows who's doing the research for real. And as, you know, as is clear, because, you know, it really proves that Albert Hoffman could not have invented LSD, and that the whole Bicycle Day story is just part of the religion. And of course, you know, that makes Albert Hoffman and Terrence McKenna, Gordon Wasson, and Timothy Leary, these guys, just hierophants of this new dark age religion that they're selling.
Well, again, fascinating stuff, but we're coming towards the end of the time, and I wanted to wrap up on the note of that dark age that that this is all meant to be starting to usher in, and unfortunately, which may have been quite effective in basically detaching people from their ability for rational thought. Let's
sure.
talk a little bit about
all
that.
Of these things together, at least, yes.
Exactly. Well, let's talk a little bit about that, and how far has this succeeded? How far has this agenda failed? What can we do to counteract the agenda?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I think the biggest thing we can do to counteract it is just to get it out there and known about as far and wide as quickly as possible. And, you know, if people just get people to understand that, hey, you know, if you're using psychedelics, have a firm understanding of logic and the logical fallacies at minimum before you dive in, because when you come out, there are a whole lot of vipers out here waiting to get you. And, you know, the Esalen Institute, Michael Murphy, all of these guys up there, I mean, these guys look like they're about the epitome of evil on the planet, if there ever was one, with the stuff that they've gotten away with. And so I forgot your point, though. I'm sorry.
Basically just asking, how do we counteract the agenda and whether it's...
And so, yeah, but yeah, just sorry, just thanks. But just, you know, continuing to reveal this, because this type of stuff only survives in ignorance and in darkness. And if we shine the light on it, you know, they're not going to be able to hide much longer. And people are going to fight it because, you know, like I said myself, I've had many of these very deep spiritual experiences with psychedelics. And I think there probably is something there. In my co-author and I on the article are, like I said, on difference with this key point. And I do think that it is possible to get valuable information out of them if used properly, and if you protect yourself and have a firm understanding of logic and the fallacy, so that when you come down, people can't fool you and trick you. And not only that, but you can filter a lot of the junk in your own mind when you're under the experience of these things and say, you know, am I fooling myself, or, you know, is this thing that I'm supposedly channeling from Uranus, is that real, or is that just, you know, was that gas, right? And so, you know, we need to be able to differentiate between these things, and, you know, what comes up in our minds, is that really something spiritual, and, you know, what steps do we take to verify it before we send it downstream as a mental virus? But I think, you know, the key thing is get people aware of Agenda 21, get people aware that MKUltra did not end, and that the real agenda with, you know, like Terrence McKenna, all of these guys, they're all selling this return to the old. Even like Daniel Pinchbeck, what is the title of his book? You know, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. Again, it's this whole, you know, and he's also out of the Esalen Institute, where they're selling all of this stuff. So, you know, once you get that it's all about the selling of the old as the good thing, and we've got to get back to that, so that basically we're all just a bunch of serfs that they're easy, you know, that's easy for them to control. That is the key idea. So getting people to critically think, to see the bigger picture, and to wake up to this agenda, regardless of their personal beliefs and feelings. I mean, look at me. I, you know, 10 years ago, I released 70 hours of Terrence McKenna audio to the internet. And now, you know, in hindsight, I'm looking at all of his research and everything going, my God, look at what he was into. So it's my duty, having discovered that I was mind controlled myself, to put this information out there to help others. And they may hate me for it in the interim, but, you know, I think that the people who take the time to actually read the information and look at it closely will find it very liberating, because it's much easier to spend a few hours or days or weeks researching facts than it is to spend a lifetime believing lies.
Well said. Well, speaking of shining the light on this and counteracting the agenda that way, let's direct people again to your website and any other resources you'd like people to take a look at.
Sure. Well, the primary website is GnosticMedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C Media.com. And we're also, I also run the TriviumEducation.com website if people want to learn more about that. And there's lots of information and research and resources up there. And then we're slowly getting together a mindcontrolexposed.com website and trying to get a conference going sometime soon regarding mind control and all of that, and sitting down and doing actual things to empower people and show them how this stuff works.
Excellent. Well, again, too much information to incorporate in one-hour interview, so we'll have to have you back on to continue talking about these subjects.
Sure.
And thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, James. I appreciate you having me on.